Welcome to another episode of the Jump Ball Podcast. I'm your host, Mo Doc Heal, and today my guest is Darius Serrano from the Form Blue and Gold. He's the head honcho there, and we do a deep dive into the Lakers draft prospects. We also talk NBA playoffs and do a little bit of our ode to Manu. So, you ready to tip it off? Darius, how you doing?
I'm good, Mo. How about yourself?
I'm doing great, man. I'm doing great. Just so everybody knows, we're recording this on a Monday evening. So we just finished watching the Warriors Golden State. That's rocket science right there. The Warriors Spurs series come to an end, and we'll talk about that at the end. But I got Darius on here, Form Blue and Gold. I know he's super happy with the result of the lottery from last week. I got to ask you, Darius, who do you like better? Who's a better fit for you, Fultz or Ball?
So in that case, if it's between Fultz and Ball, I think I'll take Fultz every single time, just because I think he's the better player. He's got the higher floor. And even if you think Ball has a potentially higher ceiling, which I can listen to arguments about that, I just think that Fultz has a really complete game, can play on or off the ball, has some good defensive potential. And I just think that he would, if he were available at two, I'd be pretty excited about that.
That's pretty interesting. Like for me, I kind of look at Fultz and I see actually a lot of D'Angelo Russell in his game a bit. And I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I haven't quite figured that part out. But I definitely feel like there's that. I kind of like Ball better with the Lakers, just in the sense of you move Russell to the two. You're able to, you got a guy who can pass. I'm not a huge Ball fan to begin with, so I want to make that known up front. But I think he kind of complements a little bit with Russell, whereas I think Fultz duplicates it a little bit. What are you seeing there? Do you see that being an issue, assuming you had Fultz?
You know, so yes and no. I think that Fultz definitely has there's much more duplication in the skill sets between the two guys. So, you know, he can be a ball dominant player. He can run a lot of pick and rolls. He can sort of create an isolation, which is a lot of the stuff that Russell does now. Fultz is also, though, a really good passer. He's not necessarily the same sort of passer that Ball is known for, right? I think Ball might have led the country in assists this season. And I spoke about this on the Laker Film Room podcast with our friend Pete, right? And I was talking about sort of Ball's spatial intelligence and just sort of how he understands how to deliver the ball to teammates, even if the passing lanes can be crowded, which I think is a really important skill set. The thing is with Fultz, though, is that I think the Lakers would do well to have a player who can actually create more shots off of the dribble as well, not only for himself, but for his teammates. I'm not necessarily sold yet that Ball is sort of that guy who you can go 1-4 with in terms of like just put him up top with the ball and tell him go create a shot for a teammate. And I think that every Laker, including Russell, would benefit from having a guy like that with him. You know, I have hopes that Ingram can become a guy like that, and he showed flashes of being able to create his own shot off of the dribble himself. But Fultz has just this wonderful pace to his game, and I think that would be a good compliment to Russell because they actually play at a similar pace. One of the things that I like about Ball to contrast is that, you know, he plays at a much faster pace and is a great transition player. And I think that will do a lot of good things for all of the Laker players as well. But when we're comparing that back to Fultz, I think Fultz can push the ball as well. But I also think that in the half court, he has a little bit more shake, a little bit more ability to create off of the dribble, which I think that would translate well to what the Lakers can do in the half court and open up some of their offense a little bit more.
Okay. I mean, I definitely could see that. And I agree with you. Ball's not really the kind of guy you just put in a 1-4 set and just say, make it happen. So I definitely see that being an issue for Ball in his NBA career.
Yeah, and I would say this too, that if we're watching the playoffs, there's a bunch of different styles to be successful, right? And you don't need to have this prototypical lead guard and say, well, this is the only way to play now. There's a bunch of different styles that can be successful in this league. And I think that the best coaches get the talent that they have and then sort of tweak and adapt and scheme and fit guys into what they like to do as coaches and then adjust what they like to do to sort of fit their personnel. And you find this happy median and get it going. And so I can say that the Lakers could play one way with Fultz and that would be successful. I could also see them integrating Ball's skill set very well. And I think that he would fit very well in what Luke Walton likes to do offensively, especially as sort of that instinctive ball mover and someone who's not going to let the ball stick with him and is consistently looking to optimize his teammates. And I think that would really fit well with what the Lakers do. I think that the concern I would have is more defensively. And when Russell and Ball are potentially your starting backcourt, I think you may end up having some of the same types of issues that the Trailblazers have, where you may end up having two dynamic offensive players, but two players as well whose defensive ceilings are probably at league average or a little bit better. And that can work if the rest of your team can sort of compensate for that. But I think what you're really looking at when you look at sort of what happens at the league level, you can maybe struggle on defense some, but your offense better be so great that you're able to just sort of outscore the opponent. And the Lakers just aren't there yet. Maybe they would be in 3 or 4 or 5 years, but you know, like those are the types of open questions that you have. And especially when you're talking about young players who oftentimes just don't defend well in general.
Right. I actually don't think Ball or Fultz is a good defender. I've watched enough defensive clips of them where I don't know with Fultz if it's just a matter if he just didn't care that much in Washington, knowing that they weren't that good at that point and kind of just didn't care, or if he's just really not that good of a defender. But I think you have those holes with both of those guys.
Yeah.
Let me ask.
I would agree with that at this point. I might just say that Fultz, to me, his ceiling on that end is probably a little bit higher than Ball's. You know, he may not have the same height, but he's got length advantages and even if you want to say that they might be equal athletically, Fultz to me has maybe a little bit more lateral quickness, right? But it's like we're projecting on to 19-year-olds, which is why the draft is complicated.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, they're at 19 and they're going to stay this way forever. No. Let me ask you this question, because would you be interested? Are you more in the camp of we got to keep this pick or we got to trade the pick?
I'm more in the keep the pick. Just because, so the way that I look at the Lakers roster is that I'm all about sort of looking at the players as still in their sort of formative stages and figuring out, well, who has the highest ceiling and do I think these guys are going to be able to get there? And so So, for example, we were you mentioned earlier about maybe this idea of replicating skill sets, and to a certain extent, I think that that's already an issue on the Lakers in certain spots, right? Like you might look at D'Angelo Russell and Jordan Clarkson and say, well, you know, within a couple of years, they may have to choose between those guys. Or a better example is probably even going to be Julius Randle and Larry Nance Jr. And I'm of the mindset, though, that, you know, Randle is likely to have a higher ceiling than Nance, even though Nance is probably, for the rest of his career, is probably going to be a better defender than Randle, and may have a little bit more polish in certain areas than Randle. But if I were a betting man, I might bet still on Randle's upside and current inconsistency over Nance's steadiness and lower ceiling. And so when I look at the pick, I'm not necessarily looking to sort of trade that pick now, because the upside of a guy that you can get at the top of the draft, yes, it'd be nice to sort of swap that guy for a known quantity, because there's no guarantee that like the number two pick will ever be as good as like Paul George or Jimmy Butler or DeMarcus Cousins, right? These are names who have been sort of floated out there as potentially available in trades, or in Cousins' case was just traded and he'll be a free agent in the summer of 2018. So these guys may never be as good as them, but the prospect of looking at the Lakers situation where they'll have some cap room and may be able to chase one or two of those guys and still retain the upside of that pick, I would go that route, I think, with the pick specifically. I'm not ruling out trading any of the Lakers' young players. It's just that if I were trading some of the young players, I would probably look at the guys who are more this may be what they are for the rest of their careers. And that that leads me more towards a guy like Clarkson or a guy like Nance. And in the right deal, maybe even Randle. But I'm not looking to trade Russell or Ingram or the draft pick.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, that definitely makes sense to me. I did kind of float it out a little bit. I think it was late last week on Twitter. Of, you know, if you do make a trade for PG, there's a possibility you might be able to entice a small little point guard from one hallway to the other hallway.
Sure.
I think that would make things interesting. But it's hard to – it's kind of why I wish I think they kind of go – the NBA would go with – I think it's Mike Zarin's idea of free agency first, then the draft.
Kind of, oh yeah, because you kind of, yeah, that'd be interesting. Sure.
Kind of have you got if you're gonna make that trade, you got to know that you're gonna get Chris Paul or somebody of that skill, or like a Kyle Lowry or something like that. And obviously, you can't talk to those guys till July, whole kind of deal. So, I think that would have that'd be something that would be interesting if there were hints to that. But I'm with you. I think you roll with the young guys you got, develop them. See what you got this year, and then you can start making decisions on guys next year when you'll have cap space and still might be able to get Paul George without having to even give up an asset.
Yeah. And I would say this too, that, I mean, if the Lakers didn't have the coach that they had, someone who was young enough to maybe grow with some of the players, or if I didn't trust the style of play or the culture that he was trying to implement, if I thought that he needed veteran guys to sort of like big name veteran guys to sort of like put in place, right? Like if the Lakers had hired Doc Rivers or someone like that, then I might think differently about this exchange of young players for more established guys. But the point that you made about developing the players, I think that where the Lakers are at now, they need to trust in their player development coaches. They need to trust in their head coach And they need to trust in sort of the staff and training people that they're putting in place to sort of optimize these young guys. And that's the thing, is that the Lakers have this sort of limited window of anywhere from 1 to 3 more years, and this excludes the number 2 draft pick this year, before their young players start to come up for their first contract extensions coming off of their rookie deals. And so to me, it's not ideal to swap out those cheap players who you'll be able to go over the salary cap to re-sign at a later date. It's better to try to, if you can, fill in the roster with free agent players who you think can be an impact for your team, and then go over the cap to re-sign the young players, or leverage their rookie contracts to then trade for the players right before they come up for extension. Very similar to what the Spurs did when they swapped out George Hill for like Kawhi Leonard or something like that, right? Where, okay, instead of paying you, we're going to try to reinvest with or go in a new direction and either grab up more young players or at that point start to trade them for more veterans to supplement the veterans that you hopefully added in free agency who can be difference makers for your team.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I buy in on that. Let me throw a hypothetical out there for you. You're in this world, you can't draft either Ball or Fultz. Who's the next guy you'd be interested in the Lakers taking?
So right now at the stage I'm at with the analysis is Josh Jackson would be that guy. You know, he's got good size for a wing, and in terms of height, he's not incredibly long. I think he's like maybe 6'8 in height, and then has like a 6'9 or 6'10 reach. So he's not like the sort of freaky length guy that Brandon Ingram is. But he's athletic, a plus athlete. He's got a really good defensive motor. He's a really good passer. And he can handle the ball some, create some shots for others, just as sort of like an offensive initiator. He can get to the glass on both backboards. And I think that he's a nice sort of, you can slot him in to lineups if you surround him with enough shooting, that he can be, like, to me, a plug-and-play wing at the NBA level, like, pretty quickly. So Jackson would be that guy. The next tier of guys that I'd be looking at is you know, Darren Fox is in that mix. And then the combo forward from Florida State is sort of an intriguing guy to me.
Jonathan Isaacs?
Yes, Isaacs. But here's the thing, is that to me, so the Lakers have been collecting picks, you know, for the last several years, and they've been, you can call it luck or skilled or whatever, but they've been, I guess fortunate might be the word, they've been fortunate enough to also grab contributing players later in the draft. So in the last 3 years, or the last 3 drafts, I should say, they've drafted Jordan Clarkson at 46, who's become a rotation player. They've drafted Larry Nance Jr. at 28, and he's become a rotation player. And they've drafted Ivica Zubac at number 32 last season, and he looks like he will become a rotation player as well. And so when you add those 3 guys to the 3 lottery picks that they've made with Randall and Russell and now Ingram, the Lakers basically have a young player at every single position. And so drafting another young guy instantly means that this guy is going to take up minutes from another player. It's just the simple math. You know, like if you draft Ball, then he's going to take away minutes from Russell and Clarkson. You know, if you draft Jackson, he's going to take away some minutes from Ingram, and then probably also steal some minutes at the two. And then a guy like Isaacs would take away minutes from the entire front court. So I don't know. And Fox would be the same way with Russell and Clarkson as well. And so I think that this is an issue that the Lakers are looking at in general, that even though they're going to be able to draft a really good player at number two, regardless, you know, in this hypothetical that you brought up without Fultz or Ball, then even if they get a guy like Jackson, I'd really like Jackson. And I could even be sold on Fox as well. I haven't done as much digging in on Fox's game yet, but I think that he'd be an intriguing fit as well. So it's interesting because I'm not exactly sure how any of these guys fit in the short term. I think that in the long term, a lot of them can be, you know, key core pieces. But I think that when you look at the Lakers, I think it's also important to sort of say, okay, after this draft, they may have as many as 8 young players on the team who are 25 or younger. By the time that they're a really good team again, not all those guys are going to be on the team. Right. And I think sooner or later, they're going to have to start making some choices about that. I know that didn't necessarily answer your question, but I think it leads into a different but yet interesting conversation. I'd love to know your thoughts as sort of an outside observer or more impartial observer about kind of what direction you think the Lakers should be going in over the next 3 or 4 years, specifically related to their young players.
Yeah, so I kind of said it a little bit earlier. I think it's, unless there's like a surefire trade and you know other pieces are about to fall, I think you stay the course with your young guys. I think this next year, it doesn't matter, right, what your win-loss record is, because you don't have the pick. It's going to Philly in 2018. So this upcoming season can really be used as an opportunity to sort of evaluate your young guys and see who fits in the puzzle and who's the type of guy you want to keep and who's the guy you don't want to keep. It's, you know, and the guys that you're willing to make move, you can move and whatnot and start kind of evaluating the market in that regards. You know, like the one thing we all know about the Lakers the last couple of years is their defense has been god awful. And, you know, when I look at the roster, I mean, there's not too many guys where I'm like, that's a lockdown defender, especially in the guard position. I think Ingram can be a pretty solid defender, but you don't have a guy that's literally like, yo, I'm going to own my guy defense. You know, I'm going to.
Yeah, there's no Patrick Beverley.
Yeah.
Like on the team, right? Or, you know, like if you don't even want to get into that level of guy, like even a guy like Danny Green or someone who's like just like, okay, this guy is super reliable defensively.
Right. And I think that's kind of the piece I'm kind of looking to see, you know, them get. And that's why it's kind of like I like the Aaron Fox. And part of it is I haven't watched a ton of him. I can't get the image out of what he did to Ball in that UCLA game. And yeah, it's actually kind of a problem in terms of scouting, because you got to be able to look at the whole picture and not the one game, right?
Yes. And also the samples are so small, man. Like we're talking about a 35 game season, maybe. That's not even half of an NBA year. If you looked at Brandon Ingram's first half of the season, you might think like, what the hell?
Right.
Why was this kid even drafted? You know what I mean? And so I'm with you there, just in terms of just like, okay, yeah, let's actually look at more, right? Like, how can we get more information?
Right. So I'm a little bit afraid that my opinion on Fox has just been so influenced by that game, because I was really impressed with just how he got into Ball, how aggressive he was defensively, and I was like, wow, that's that. And I think De'Aaron Fox is going to be good in the league for a long time. You know, the stories you hear about him is, you know, he's a competitive guy, hardworking guy. I think his shot will improve. I don't think he'll ever be a straight knockdown guy, but I think he'll be good enough to stay on the court and not hurt you offensively. But, you know, that's the kind of guy I'd like to see them find a way to get at one point or another, because I think that's something I want to see on this team, and I want to see that development as well. You know, I think this year and this past season and the upcoming season next year, it's really an evaluation phase of who are the guys we want to go to war with? Who do we want to roll with for the next 6 or 7 years? Who's our core?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's kind of the thing. So I think this next season is huge for D'Angelo. I think it's huge for Randall. You know, how they develop and what the Lakers are going to have that time to start figuring out, hey, this is who these guys can project to be. And they're on that route. You know, they're working their butts off, or the other way around. They're not working their asses off. We don't think they're going to be the guy we thought they would be. We need to trade them now while we can get value. So I think that's how I would work it if I were the Lakers in terms of what I'm doing. Now with the pick, I think you go best available guy, the best talent that can help you. You know, when you're as bad as they are, you don't worry about need as much. It's about just getting talent.
Yeah, it can't just be about fit, right? Like, I think that as Laker fan, like, when I listen to fans talk, and I fall into this trap myself a little bit, is like, well, how does this guy fit next to Russell? Or how does he, you know, is he, I was just talking about this, right? Like, is he going to steal minutes from Ingram or steal minutes from Randall? And I think that that's important, and it should be a factor within the decision making. But I was saying this a couple of years ago, that it's like, or have been saying this for a couple of years, that it's like, you don't even know, like, one of these guys could be better than Russell. Like one of these guys could be better than Randall. And if that ends up being the case, then you probably have a franchise player.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, at a certain time, there are certain teams that you go, okay, you got to start thinking fit. You know, like, I think the Sixers at 3 might want to start thinking fit, because they can't draft another center, for God's sakes.
Yeah, or even another, like, ball-handling forward.
Yeah.
For example.
Yeah, like, they need to start thinking fit a little bit more, because especially in the East, it's not that hard for them to kind of rise very quickly if health cooperates and things kind of bounce the correct way. The Lakers aren't in that position yet. So they got to start thinking, we just need talent on the roster, and we'll figure the rest out. And it helps now with how the game's changed, and you could play, you know, 4 guys, 5 guys. I mean, look at the Warriors. They can play 5 out. Their best lineup doesn't even have an actual center. So, you know, the game's changing a little bit, so there could be room for other guys and more interesting lineups, and you don't have to worry so much about, am I going to find enough playing time for these guys? You know, and if you're Luke Walton, the best guys are going to play. The guys who are going to bust their asses are going to play. You know, the guys who are going to put in the work, who are listening and paying attention and putting in that extra time, they're the ones who are going to get minutes, and it doesn't matter where you've been drafted. So I think that's the goal, I think, for the Lakers. I think that should be the goal.
Yeah, and I definitely – I'm on board with that, And I think that that's why, just like you said, that this is a really important summer especially for Randall and Russell. You know, Ingram's still so young. I think he's naturally going to improve. But, you know, Randall's entering his extension eligible year, basically. And how he plays this upcoming season is essentially going to determine his value on the restricted free agent market, right? So he's going to need to figure out exactly what type of player he's going to be and whether or not the style that he's going to play is actually going to contribute to wins rather than just numbers. And I'm a believer in Julius Randle, more so than I think some of my Laker fan brethren. You know, like I understand the holes in this game, and I'm not gonna gloss over those things. I just think that by the time that he's sort of in his 6th or 7th year, the light will have turned on for him. It's one of those I don't die on many hills. But Randall is one of those hills that I'm willing to die on. I'm gonna go to bat for him until it's pretty much completely obvious that I'm in the wrong.
Right.
Like, he's just that intriguing a player to me. And in very similar ways, I believe in Russell the same way. Like, I know he's got a bad rap for a variety of reasons that we don't need to get into, but I just think that if you were to tell, like, you've watched some tape on Ball and you've watched Ball play, I've done the same. I went through a pretty extensive process when the Lakers were selecting number two the year that D'Angelo Russell came out. And, you know, as an overall prospect, I can honestly say that I was more impressed with Russell at this stage of my analysis than I am with Ball. That's nothing against Ball, but Russell was just this complete package offensively, and Ball's not. And I just think that Russell's going to have that breakthrough. And that's why I am not quick at all to sort of throw Russell into these trade talks that a lot of fans are willing to sort of hold his name out there as this expendable piece, because the Lakers are going to draft Lonzo Ball. Like, I just don't see it that way.
Yeah, no, Laker fans have driven me nuts all year, because as you died on the hill for Randall, I camped on the Russell hill, not knowing how good he is, if he's going to reach the potential he's, you know, I think he can get to. But, like, just amazed with how quickly Laker fans are ready to give up on him. And I don't get it. I just think the guy's in his third year, or he's going to be coming into his third year. He's putting up pretty good numbers. I said, yeah, you know, there's some other stuff and extracurricular activities. But for the most part, it's like, come on, guys. Like, he's actually been pretty solid. He was probably the best Laker, I think, last year, in my opinion. And I just don't know where all this hate and comes from towards him. And I think, you know, I prefer him over Ball or Fultz.
Interesting. That's interesting to me that you would say Fultz as well.
Yeah, no, I think I would take him. You know, the first thing I saw, one of the first games I watched with Russell, it was his rookie year, I think. You know, he comes off a pick and roll, hits the roller, you know, right in stride, boom, dunk. You know, they run the same play again when he comes off the pick and roll. You know, the defense reacted and really sucked in to take the roller away, and he whips a pass to the weak side corner for a three. And I was just like, dude, there are guys in the league, there are point guards in the league who are in there for 6 years, can't make that pass.
Yes.
And I'm just like, that's talent.
Yeah, like, I'm with you. One of the things that I've harped on Russell to fans pretty much all year is that when you consistently watch the Lakers play, he's the only player on the court or on the entire roster. He was the only player on the entire roster that could basically make every pass
that
you needed. Every single pass. Right. And so he's handling up high and he's hitting Nick Young on pin downs right in the shooting pocket. Right. For easy jumpers. He's hitting Clarkson in stride on curls to get into the lane. He's running pick and roll actions and he's making the over the top pass to the diving big man. He's freezing defenders when he comes off the screen to sort of make the tag man just hesitate a little bit so that he to open up both the roll man or the strong side or weak side corner. He's making the pocket bounce pass. You know, the only pass he doesn't really make with regularity is the lob coming off of the pick and roll. And that's really because he's still not threatening the paint as much coming off of the pick and roll. He honestly prefers to put players in jail rather than sort of explode off of the pick. But I honestly think that that's an aspect of his game that he's going to add that he's going to be able to start to turn the corner and get into the lane to shoot his little floater. And once he starts to get into the lane to shoot the floater, that's going to open up the lob. And I just see the progression. I see where the progression is going, and there's no way in hell I'm going to just give that up when I see the path and it's not a stretch to say that he's going to get there.
Yeah. And to real quickly, just so the listeners understand what Darius means when he means coming off the screen and putting a guy in jail, it basically means putting him on their back hip. You know, we call it a crossback or a snake dribble when they come off a pick and roll, and it cuts off anybody to be – basically, your defender is going over the top of the screen. It cuts off any chance he has to get in front of you. I'm assuming that's what you're talking about, Darius, right?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And Russell, as a big guard, one of the things that I wanted him to start doing more of was play with a little bit of a wider base coming off the screens, because because he's so tall, and that one of the critiques I had of him coming out of the draft was that his handle was a bit too loose because he kept his dribble a little bit too high. But towards the second half of the season, he got a lot better with that. And as he physically matures and gets even stronger, that he's going to put players on his hip and they're not going to be able to shake free. I don't know if a perfect example of that is, like, watch the way that like, if you didn't get a chance this year to go back and look at some of the ways that Joe Johnson plays. You know, he's like the classic example, and I think that Russell can develop into that sort of in-between scorer where it's like, okay, he's just getting to this spot, and because he's just bigger than a lot of the guys who are guarding him, especially when he's playing point guard, he's going to be a really tough guy to stop. And that's why during the second half of the season, you know, he's putting up 20 points and he's barely breaking a sweat. And maybe to some fans, that's like, oh, well, there goes Russell with his nonchalant style. But it's like, look, man, guys like that just don't grow on trees.
Right. And that's the thing. I think people really have they just think it's so easy. And they think these guys should come in and from day one produce and all that stuff. And there's that pressure of it happens with the Lakers. It happens with these legendary organizations where, you know, USC football is an example. UCLA basketball is another example where if you don't win right away, it's like you suck playing it.
Yes.
I think that's kind of part of it, too, is that pressure from Laker fans. Like I used to get – if I went on a podcast and I preached patience to Laker fans, I'd get 5 tweets from people saying, like, no true Laker fan will ever be patient. I was just like, dude, wow, okay, you got problems. But that's the thing. Like, they need to be patient with this group because they might really be set up really well down the road if they can just try to figure out what they got.
Oh, yeah, I 100% agree.
Perfect. One real quick you know, because I know I haven't gone deep into it. I don't think you have either in the draft. What type of player are you looking for? Do you think you would want to see drafted at 28? Not necessarily a name, but give me like the profile. Is it a Euro stash project? Is it maybe it's a fourth year senior who may be a little older and can bring some maturity to the squad? What are you looking for?
You know, it's interesting, and so I would not be against a draft and stash. Sort of like a Euro player, like either a guy on the wing who has some defensive potential or even a big man who is a bit more athletic, who can run the floor a bit and maybe play above the rim a little bit. I know that that doesn't necessarily fit the classic European profile, right? But those guys do exist. You know, they're not just all stretch big men, although that's the second thing I would probably be looking at is either a 4 or a 5 or, you know, like either a pure four who can slide up some or a five, but a big guy who can either stretch the floor or a big guy who has some real defensive potential. You know, especially if that guy who has defensive potential can be a rim runner or a guy who in the pick and roll can play above the rim and finish lobs, you know, sort of like, you know, like the
kind of like a DeAndre Jordan or.
Sure. Or even like, I mean, so the Lakers had Tarik Black, right? I had a soft spot for Tarik Black. Like he's, you know, even though he's only 25, he's sort of like that old soul type of player where he's very mature. He's just offers a lot of like nuance and perspective when you listen to him talk, and he's an incredibly hard worker and he fits that profile wonderfully, right? Like he gets after it defensively. He works hard on both backboards, is a great offensive rebounder, and he will play above the rim. He's also like 6'7" or 6'8", right? Like he just doesn't offer prototypical size for that position. And he can make up for it with motor and with smarts and with angles and leverage and all kinds of other stuff that you know happens in the trenches at the NBA level. I'd love to get a guy like Tarik Black, but who's a legit, you know, like 6'11".
Gotcha.
Right? Like so there's I think a few guys in the draft who might fit in either of those templates, right? Like a big man who can maybe defend the rim some and maybe stretch the floor some, you know, do one of the other, do a little bit of both. That's the kind of guy that I'd be looking at late in the draft at 28, you know, whether it's a guy like Giles who might slip down that far, although that's questionable because he was such a high recruit going into Duke but has dealt with injuries, or whether it's the big French center, I think his last name is Jean. There's the kid from Alabama, first name is Bam, but I can't remember his last name.
If your first name's Bam, you don't need a last name.
Yeah, that's what that,
let's just be honest. Right. Unless your last name is Bam, unless it's Bam Bam. You really don't need another name though. If it's Bam, that's it. You're good.
Yes. Yeah, you're going to go down in the one name hall of fame,
all
right,
the way.
Guys?
You win. That's
yes.
It.
Right. And so those are a few interesting names that in various mock drafts I've seen sort of slip down to where the Lakers are selecting. And I think that any of those guys or just in general guys who sort of fit the profile that I was describing are guys I'd be looking at, you know. So
I'm going to be honest, at 28, the only criteria I'm looking at in these guys is whether they like gelato. Because if they're going to be a Laker and they're going to like gelato, I got the perfect place for them, Darius. It's called Uli's Gelateria in downtown L.A. It's in the Spring Arcade in between 5th and 6th Street. It's awesome, dude. They got the best people. The service is great. They have some of the best flavors. You know, I always talk about Speculoos cookies is usually my go-to. But if you want to mix it up, they have basil gelato. They have olive oil. They have the
basil.
Basil. I didn't even know you could make that an actual flavor, but you can. And they knocked it out of the park. Like I saw,
I'm down for some basil gelato. That sounds impressive.
It's impressive. You can't go wrong with that place. And gelato's nice. It's got a little light feeling for you. It's not too heavy as ice cream. It's a little better for you. And it's definitely worth checking out. I'm telling you, Darius, if you're in downtown, check it out. It's not far from my place. Just yell for me, and I'll come down and treat you. It's on Spring Street in between 5th and 6th. It's in the Spring Arcade. I couldn't recommend it enough. Uli's Gelateria. Definitely check it out.
Oh man! See, now I want some gelato. You see what you did?
You know, it's tough when we do these late at night. Like gelato's got to be like for me, it's like a midday thing. So next time, you know, I should have had you on during the season and then had taken you to gelato afterwards.
Well, it's never too late for gelato.
There we
go. As far as I'm concerned.
Okay. Well, there you go. Darius is going to go right now. So if anybody wants to go meet Darius, he'll be at Uli's Gelateria when we're done with the podcast. One thing I wanted to talk about, I want to get away from the Lakers a little bit because I want to talk about the teams that are still playing.
Sure, let's do it.
Celtics upset the Cavs last night, you know, on a Sunday evening game. Great game. I mean, they got a lot of help. I mean, Marcus Smart hit 7 threes. Jonas Derebko talked shit to everybody on the court, including the nacho cheese guy in Cleveland, and was 2 for 2 from three, and everybody was making shots. Is this the Celtics kind of delaying the inevitable? I can't even say that word. Or is this the start of another run where they go from being down 0-2 to tying the series up?
So definitely not the latter.
Great. So moving on.
I mean, you know, no offense to the Celtics. So let's say that, you know, so missing Thomas hurts their offense, but plugging in Marcus Smart helps their defense tremendously. And so even though the Cavs still scored at a very high rate, Boston's defense was just much more active and had that sort of sense of purpose on the floor for much longer stretches than they've had the entire series. And that matters. And they definitely played with their backs were against the wall and they had something to prove and all the cliches, right? But the flip side of that is that Marcus Smart's a terrible three-point shooter. I think I read a stat yesterday that mentioned something that he's the first player in the history of the NBA to shoot as poorly as he did on three-pointers during the year, because I believe he was a sub 30% three-point shooter on a high volume of threes. He's the first player to sort of fit that profile: poor shooter, high volume, and then make 7 three-pointers in a playoff game. So that's never happened ever. And that's basically what Boston needed to win that game. I just don't think that they can replicate that over the course of a series. To me, that game felt like sort of this confluence of events that really worked well in Boston's favor. You know, even though the Cavs were hitting shots themselves, Kevin Love played great. And J.R. Smith hit some timely threes. And there was that, but there was still that stretch during the third quarter where basically Boston couldn't miss. And let's face it, they were down 20-something points. And looked like the Cavs sort of let the foot off the gas. The Celtics got hot. They started to make some really tough shots. Like, they just found that momentum, that mo, right?
I was there. I showed up.
Yes, you were there in spirit, right? And they just pulled it out. And even on the very last play where Bradley got that wide open three, that was a very well-designed play, but it was also a pretty bad miscommunication between J.R. Smith and Iman Shumpert. And that's kind of what it took for them to win the game on a last-second shot. Oh, and did I mention that LeBron played his worst game of the playoffs?
Yeah, that's the other thing, too. You know, it's when you look at it, I don't even think their defense got LeBron to play that bad. I just think LeBron had an off night, and he was due for one. And I'm not – people were kind of like trashing his legacy. Again, NBA Twitter is an amazing place. Man. The psychology of it is just phenomenal to me sometimes. But, you know, they start trashing his legacy. I'm like, he just played 10 straight amazing games.
Yeah, they hadn't lost, and he was averaging, like, you know, only like 35 points and 8 or 9 rebounds and 7 or 8 assists and shooting like 57% from the field. I think before this past game, he hadn't shot under 50% in a playoff game yet.
Right. Like, it's like, that's such a mind-boggling stat, just considering how much harder teams play in the playoffs. And I know they ran through Toronto. I know they had that Indiana has given them the best series. I mean, now Boston, you can say Boston because they won a game, but Indiana would given them the most running in games. But even then, it was like he really just kind of went another level. And I don't think their defense kind of made that happen. They played better defensively, especially on the other guys. But I don't feel like their defense kind of took LeBron out of it. I think he just kind of made a few bad passes, and it just kind of kept getting worse from there. To me, a couple of things that were really telling for me about this game that I found interesting, and I'm with you. It's over. Boston, congratulations, you won a game. That's awesome. I mean, I think this is still going to be a series in five. But, one, if the Cavs screw up that kind of switch, wait till they get in the finals when that's pretty much all the Warriors run. You know, when the Cavs screw up the switch down at the end of the game that gave Bradley that game-winning three, like, they're going to be seeing these kinds of picks all game long in the finals. You know, and if you screw up a switch, it's going to be Curry, it's going to be Durant, and it's going to be Klay. These guys are going to kill you on that. And then the other aspect of it, too, was this was the game for me that Kyrie had to take over. And, you know, LeBron didn't play well. And again, when you compare it to the Warriors, you know, if Steph has a bad night, they have KD, they have Klay, they have Draymond, they have guys that really step up. For the Cavs, it's got to be Irving. And to his credit, he played well. He had a nice stat line. He had 29 points. He ended up having a plus-minus of zero, but was a minus 16 in the second half. He scored a couple buckets down the stretch, but it just didn't feel like he really was like, yo, I'm taking it over. I'm and excuse the phrase, but he's like, I'm going to put my nuts on the table. Like, I'm taking this. This is mine. And that was something that was really telling for me about the series and kind of gave me insight into the finals and where I'm like, this is really where they're going to have problems. So for me, I just think this year, I think it's over. I'm happy they got a game. I'm happy we got a good game out of it. But I the series is over to me.
Yeah, I can't endorse the Celtics even winning one more game. Like, this felt like one of those games where the Cavs destroyed them in game two, right? Sort of like broke their spirit, then went up huge in game three. And like I said, let the foot off the gas and maybe thought, okay, like they're buried, you know? And the Celtics, to their credit, they've got some really scrappy guys, you know, Smart and Crowder, Horford, you know, they've got some, and they're well coached. And Bradley too, as sort of that scrapper mentality, and they just battled back and clawed back, and the Cavs did their best to sort of hit some big shots themselves, but you know it really came down to who had the ball last, and that was Boston. So
yeah, and that's the other thing too, which was great. If that shot's a swish, there's at least another second, and the Cavs get to run a play.
Yes. I know. Instead, it hit literally every part of the rim, maybe twice.
Yeah. And then it kind of rolls in, and it's point one. I'm like, well, that was pretty – that worked. That couldn't have worked out better for the Celtics.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let's talk real quickly about the series that ended tonight. The Warriors sweeping the Spurs. A lot of things going on. One thing I also want to mention is it's quite possible, and it really feels like it, this might actually have been Manu Ginobili's last game.
Yes, I know. Ginobili was always one of my favorites, man.
Ginobili is one of my favorites. I'm not going to – I tweeted out a little story of when Manu played a prank on me on my first road trip with – coincidentally playing the Lakers, my first road trip with the Spurs as an assistant. And he basically put the cap back on the projector just before pregame film. And I was out of the room, and I come back to a black screen. And everything else is on. Like, everything should be working, but the screen's entirely black, and I have 2 minutes before the pregame meeting starting, and I started to panic. I was already nervous. It's my first road trip with the Spurs, and, you know, I didn't want Pop to think I'm a complete idiot. I mean, I am, but I didn't want him to know that yet.
Sure.
And all that, and I'm freaking out, and everything looks great, and I don't understand why all the connections are tight and everything. Like, what's going on? I'm freaking out. And kind of like at the corner of my eye, I see Manu just staring and laughing so incredibly hard And I just immediately knew, I was like, oh, Manu did something. And then I look and the cap is on the projector and I take that off. And I just kind of gave him a look of like, I hate you so much, Manu.
Yes. Yes.
I've always loved Manu as a player, and I can't say enough. He's one of my favorites. He's, you know, a highly intellectual guy, great conversationalist. You know, I was lucky to work with the Spurs for 2 years and get to be around his company. But, you know, what are your favorite thoughts about Manu? And then we'll talk about the Warriors.
Oh, just the sort of flair that he plays with. So I'm a lefty as well.
You and me and Manu.
Yeah. So I'm a left-hander. So I have an affinity for left-handed players in general. You know, Lamar Odom is also one of my favorite players. When I was like not quite a kid, you know, and like those Lake Show Lakers, Van Exel was one of my guys too. So you know, just yeah. Give me some lefties and let's go to. And let's go to town. And so, but Manu was just the creativity as a player, not only as a scorer, but especially as a passer. You know, when I played organized basketball, I was a point guard, and obviously I'm a Laker fan. So, and I grew up on the Showtime Lakers with Magic Johnson, and so I always thought that there was a certain if you could get away with it and it contributed to winning, that flair and sort of showmanship adds to the game experience. And Manu is cut from that. He is cut from that same cloth, where he just understands that we're out here playing a game, and it should be fun, and there's joy in this, and there should be some risk involved, and he was never scared of the moment. He was never scared to play his style, and coaches' wishes be damned. Right. Like I remember early in his career and I've heard Greg Popovich talk about this, too, in terms of reflecting on Manu, that, you know, he sort of looked at Manu in the beginning as like this wild horse that needed to be tamed. And what he realized was after a couple of seasons that, you know, there was no taming this guy. And what you really had to do was just let him roam free. And this is where I think sort of Popovich's fourth sort of vision and forward thinking to put him on the bench and sort of let him be this singular force and this orchestrator of the second unit, where he could sort of be this ball dominant player and really show off the full spectrum of his game. Like I think that's what made fans, especially Spurs fans, fall in love with him, and NBA fans in general just be so appreciative of what he brought to the table as a player and as a competitor, just a guy that went out there and played hard and left it all on the floor and played with an honesty and an integrity that sometimes, not to, you know, knock the Spurs here, but could sometimes belies a couple of the other players that have sometimes donned their uniform. There was always just that level of class that he exuded I'm just a Ginobili fan.
Yeah. You know, one last point about Manu, too, was that he kind of was like Brett Favre in a way.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, no, that's a good comp.
You know,
that's
and he's going to – you got to live with those picks he's going to throw, because he's going to throw some amazing bombs. And that was it. That was a hard thing for Pop to have to learn. Obviously, I wasn't around for that part where, you know, Manu was already established at that point when I was there. But having that – to figure out how to coach him, and you got to live with sometimes he's just going to take shots and you're just going to sit there and be like, fuck, that was a bad shot, but it's Manu. You have to deal with it. It's definitely one of those, because he's going to take another shot where you're like, no, okay.
Yeah, and I think the great part about him is that, you know, like, he built up the equity.
Yeah.
Right? That only, like, you have to be a certain caliber of player to even be able to live through that with a coach like Pop. Right? That you have to prove that you're going to perform and actually achieve at a certain level before he's going to really just take the reins off completely and just say, you know, go out there and do your thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Any thoughts on the Warriors, or do you want to just leave it there?
No, like, I don't really have much to say about the Warriors. You know, I was watching the game tonight with my wife, and then she had a couple of friends over, and we were all watching the game. And honestly, I haven't said this much about the Warriors this year, even though I know that it's been sort of a growing sentiment about their season, but this game was pretty boring. You know, like, the Spurs would get close a little bit, and then the Warriors would just put their foot on the gas a little bit more, accelerate, and you know, and an 8-point game never felt so out of reach to me. Because it would literally be 2.5 minutes of game time, and it was back up to 18. And that's what the Warriors are now, is that, especially now that they're sort of there. And this is the thing too, is they're not even firing like Klay is not playing very good offensive basketball now. To be fair to him, he's working really hard defensively. He's taking the top, you know, guard assignment every single night. But, you know, imagine if Klay was actually hitting shots at, like, a reasonable rate. You know, like, I looked up and at one point, and Klay was 1 for 8. And I think the Warriors were up 15, and they're cruising. And obviously they're playing a diminished Spurs team, you know, with no Kawhi Leonard, no Tony Parker, and that plays into this. But, I mean, look, man, like, they did this against Portland. They did it against who they play in around Utah. They did against Utah. They're just at another level when they're at even close to their peak. And honestly, I'm not, like, counting the Cavs out at all, because I've learned not to count out LeBron James. But they are a different animal now that they have Durant, because they don't even necessarily need Thompson now to be at his best. And then if Klay starts to turn it on, and that's in a game where Steph is actually just playing even moderately well, and KD is just, you know, Durant just playing his normal style, they're going to win games by, you know, going away by 20, 25 points, and it's going to look easy.
What I find really interesting is, I mean, I'm looking forward to the finals. I think it's going to be a fun finals. I really hope so, between Cleveland and Golden State. But I don't think people realize, too, is wait till next season when these guys have, you know, that their chemistry is really kind of developed and they're going to feel even more comfortable with each other. I mean, the longer this goes and the more you feel with, like, this whole year was them feeling out Durant and Durant feeling them out. Wait till next year. And I know they have some guys to re-sign and figure out a few roster maneuvers, and they've done a good job as a front office. But I'm like, man, I said, next year they're going to even be more comfortable. And I could see them just walk through the season again and win 65 games, you know. And
They can do that sleepwalking, man. Like, as long as everyone's, like, relatively healthy, they can do that. And they can do that even resting guys.
I mean, they could basically rest a guy each game if they wanted to and still have, you know, a top 3 seed in the West.
Oh yeah. Oh, easy. They could win 50 games playing if Steph and KD only played like 60 games each.
I mean, it's amazing. That's an amazing thing to say, but that's kind of where we're at with that. So, I think that's it, man. Darius, tell the people where they can find you. Tell them what to look for coming out from you and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, so I can be found at forumblueandgold.com. You can find me on Twitter at forumbluegold. And you can listen to me talk some more, as if I didn't talk enough today. You can listen to me talk some more when I do the Laker Film Room podcast with our buddy Pete Zayas, who's at Laker Film Room. And upcoming stuff, you know, just gearing up for the draft. We're going to be doing player profiles for the number 2 pick. We're going to be doing some player profile stuff for the number 28 pick. We'll be talking team building, off-season strategy, free agency, trades, kind of what we think the team should be doing. So it'll be a good time. And then, you know, and maybe I'll even sneak in a few playoff thoughts about what's going on with the finals. So
perfect,
should
perfect.
Be good.
My one rule, again, whoever we pick at 28th has to like gelato. That needs to be a requirement. Send that up the flagpole. And the other thing, too, is I would like everybody to take a look. If you really enjoy Darius' stuff like I do, take a look at his Patreon page, support his work. It's definitely worth it. Give him a subscription. If you're interested in his stuff, he always has good intel, especially about what's going on with the Lakers. I highly recommend you guys kind of support him in that sense. Darius, that's it, man. Thank you so much, man.
Thanks for having me on, Mo. Appreciate it. Anytime.
And that's it for this episode. Be sure to rate us, like us, leave reviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. And have yourselves a great one, guys.